Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
He got up from the table at which we were working, went over to his desk to get the Coke, looked at the can and asked, "Who has put pubic hair on my Coke?"
This is a circus. It's a national disgrace. It is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves.
Well, anybody among you who was following the news 20 years ago knows those clips. And NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us now on the occasion of the 20th anniversary last week of the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings. It was Nina who broke the story of Ms. Hill, who reported to Thomas at the U.S. Education Department and then the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Washington, accusing the Supreme Court nominee of sexual harassment. We will test my recollection that the FBI had the accusation but did not include it in its report about Thomas's background. But the story broke just days before a vote was scheduled on Thomas's confirmation and caused the confirmation hearings to be reopened and caused Nina Totenberg to be forced to testify before a separate congressional hearing. Nina has been looking back at the episode and at Clarence Thomas's influence on America as clearly our most conservative Supreme Court justice. And Nina, thanks for doing this with us. Welcome back to WNYC. Hard to think that it's been so long.
It is hard to think. I don't think your recollection is right, by the way. I think that what happened was that Anita Hill finally gave an affidavit to the Judiciary Committee. And the FBI then went to interview her at the behest of the Judiciary Committee. I don't believe there was anything about this in the initial report.
Okay.
But since I've never seen the initial report, I'm not 100% sure.
Why hadn't Anita Hill come forward during the whole rest of the confirmation process?
I think that she didn't want her she didn't want to become the center of a controversy. So she actually told investigators on the Judiciary Committee about this. I think they contacted her, but didn't want to. Wasn't really interested initially in making an affidavit. She just wanted it generally this investigated, and you can't do that in American life. If you're going to make a charge, you got to put your name on it. And I think that's what one or more senators told her, and she finally gave them an affidavit.
Because somebody's going to leak it to NPR. And so the vote was already about to come up in the Senate. The hearings had been held when you broke the story. So I'm sure you don't want to reveal your sources even today, but to the extent you can say, you learned what, when, how.
Well, the only thing I can say for myself is that at the time of the initial vote, Senator Biden, now Vice President Biden, who is chairman of the committee, said something at the hearing, at the vote, saying something like, "There have been all kinds of nefarious charges, and I just want to say we're not going to go into that kind of thing." And I really didn't know what kind of nefarious charges he was talking about. So I sort of journalistically started kicking tires, and that finally produced the information about Anita Hill. And when I called her, she initially did not want to talk to me. She knew why I was calling. I had done some research about her and found her to be a person of good repute, not some kook. And she didn't want to talk to me, and she said she would only talk to me if I got her affidavit. And I think she thought that I wouldn't get the affidavit. But, you know, that's a little bit like waving a red flag in front of a bull. I got the affidavit.
Yeah. What were your conversations like with your editors? Did you or NPR management have any doubt about whether to air the story?
No, but, you know, it's really interesting. Today, I would have aired it probably, I think, 2 days earlier. I waited. I held the story for a while because I was trying to get hold of Senator Biden to get his comment about why the Judiciary Committee had not explored this. And I couldn't get a response. They weren't in Washington. He was in Delaware. I called everybody on his staff I could think of, including his Delaware person. And I finally, I finally got a couple of other members of the Judiciary Committee to talk to me, one on the record, Senator Simon, at least another one off the record, I think. And I said, well, I can't wait for the chairman. If he doesn't want to talk, I'm not going to wait. And then we did the story.
With the 24-hour news cycle of today, you may not have decided that you had the luxury to wait.
No, I wouldn't have waited. I would have said, you know, you've got a half an hour.
Yeah. The country was divided on whether they believed Hill's accusation or Thomas's denial. Have you come to a firm belief over the years about who was telling the truth?
No. And I've actively prevented myself from doing that.
Why?
I'm a journalist. I'm a reporter. I cover the court. This was my story. I thought it was a credible story. But, you know, Thomas was, you saw what I saw, and I don't think we actually have proof positive. Lots of people have their opinions, but I don't think it's in my interest to actually resolve this based on an opinion as opposed to facts.
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg looking back on maybe the biggest story she ever broke, Anita Hill's accusation against Clarence Thomas 20 years ago this month. You were called before Congress, accused by some Republicans of political bias for reporting the story at all, and asked to reveal your confidential sources. You refused, and they eventually dropped the matter. But was there any point at which you thought you were going to jail?
Well, I went on television on every talk show you can think of, and said I was willing to go to jail. I didn't much like the idea, and I think that it was an election year, and by then it was 1992, I think. It was an election year, and I think my colleagues thought I wouldn't go to jail because, do you really want to put a female reporter in jail over breaking a story that has been a cause célèbre? And at the time, I'm not sure I believed them, but I think in the last analysis, that's true. That's what happened.
So forget the Clarence Thomas hearings for a minute. Do you think the Nina Totenberg hearing has had any lasting impact on freedom of the press or the relationship between the press and government?
Actually, no. I don't know a reporter on earth worth his or her salt who, having had this idea and getting the information that I was able to get, would have then said, oh, gee, I shouldn't report this. So that was true then, and it's true now.
What about the Thomas confirmation process itself, including the Anita Hill chapter? Do you think that that has had lasting impact on the way we nominate and confirm Supreme Court justices or on the political polarization that we're still obviously struggling with today?
Oh, it definitely did, but so did the Bork hearings.
Which was 4 years earlier.
Yeah, and in some ways, the Thomas confirmation hearings, the first round, were a reaction to the Bork hearings. Judge Bork had spent, I think, 5 days answering questions about his very conservative judicial philosophy, about which he had written extensively and spoken extensively. And the way in which he answered those questions was not well received, let's put it that way. And he was easily defeated, which was not at all a foregone conclusion. In fact, when he was nominated, I don't think you would have gotten, you could have gotten a bet that he wasn't going to get confirmed. So in reaction to that, the Thomas hearings were very scripted, say-nothing hearings, in which he had no opinions about anything. And the emphasis was on his early years, his upbringing, his poor childhood in poverty, his struggle, his very admirable ability to rise above his beginnings and become a person of considerable mm-hmm. stature, now nominated to the court.
And nominees have been saying nothing ever since.
Yeah.
By the way, people may forget that Thomas wasn't the only Supreme Court nominee who you've broken stories about. Didn't you also reveal that Justice William Rehnquist, when President Reagan nominated him for Chief Justice, had written that the Equal Rights Amendment would hasten the dissolution of the family and would virtually abolish all legal distinction between men and women?
You know, I hate to admit this, Brian, but if I broke that story, I don't remember.
Oh, okay. I thought that was you. But you did report that Douglas Ginsburg, a Reagan nominee, had smoked pot a few times as a student and a young college professor?
Yes, I did, and that actually led to his nomination being withdrawn.
And funnily enough, to me anyway, you won the broadcast journalism's highest honor for the Ginsburg story, didn't you, the DuPont Award?
Well, I don't think it was. Yes, I think it was. It was in part for the Ginsburg Award. It was for breaking investigative story deadline or something like that.
Why did you bother looking back at that with that revelation, which today I think most people of both parties would consider irrelevant to his qualifications?
Well, I always look back at nominees. You go and you find out anything you can. You're not looking for dirt. You're looking for who they are and what the way they have behaved and done their and what they think and how they've conducted themselves and what they're open to or not open to, what kind of a person they are. You're really looking for some idea of what kind of a justice this is going to be. And when you stumble upon something like this, which was, and I did stumble upon it, in those days, in those days during the Reagan administration, if you were applying for a job as a low-level federal prosecutor and you filled out your form and admitted that you had smoked marijuana, after being admitted to the bar, you were automatically not considered for the job. And and people came out of the woodwork and said to me I had jobs withdrawn because I filled out that form truthfully under penalty of perjury.
Right, and there was that fact about him. A couple of other things before you go, real quick. We have 2 minutes. Critics of Thomas today are questioning his fitness to rule on some cases, including a possible Obama health reform individual mandate case, because his wife has been an outspoken Tea Party supporter and Obama health reform critic. Does a spouse's political activity ever result in recusal? Is there any history of that?
No. And all of the ethics professors and experts will say to you that the ethics rules are written to accommodate a spouse who does something, does and has views that are different or the same or whatever as the justice. And justices are not required to recuse themselves simply because their spouses are politically active. If the spouse has a financial interest, then the justice is required to recuse him or herself, but not for simply having political activity.
Or if he himself is seen around the margins of her political activity, is there a hazy line there?
Well, you know, you're not supposed to do things if you're a judge, to raise money for any political cause or actually for almost any cause. But being seen around the margins, you can't live a life in Washington without being seen around the margins of political life. Everything around here is somewhat political.
And is the Obama health reform individual mandate going shortly before the Supreme Court?
It is currently pending, and very likely the justices will accept the case for review because there's a conflict in the lower courts, and it's a very, you know, big deal. But let it be said that in the 20 years in which he has served, Justice Thomas has distinguished himself greatly as the court's most conservative member and also a very respected member.
Before you go, do you consider the Anita Hill story sort of the biggest scoop you ever got?
I guess yes, because of what happened afterwards. I've done stories that I thought were as important, but they didn't have that effect.
Yeah. NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg, keep it up. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.